In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Okay. So we were on page 10 of the text by Maitreya, Distinguishing Dharma. Distinguishing phenomena from their intrinsic nature. Maitreya's Dharma Dharmatavibhanga with commentaries by Kibo Jinga and Ju Mipham. So we are in the section that is the summary of the two topics, or the two sort of things, so to speak, that are being distinguished, phenomena and their essence. The characteristics of cyclic existence and the transcendence of suffering. This second section includes discussions of the characteristics of phenomena and the characteristics of their intrinsic nature. On the first, the treatise states, here phenomena are defined as the appearances of duality and of things expressed, the appearances of the false imagination. They appear, yet do not exist, therefore they are false. These, as well, are entirely non-existent in actuality. Since they are merely concepts, they are imaginary. It may be said, that may be so, but because their characteristics have not been expressed, the characteristics of phenomena cannot be known. Excuse me. That's an odd interchange, isn't it? It may be said, well, that may be so, but because their characteristics have not been expressed, the characteristics of phenomena cannot be known. It's an odd thing to say. Who would say that? Here, phenomena are defined as the appearances of the duality of the entities of apprehender and apprehended, and of things expressed through the imputations of essences and distinctions, i.e., the appearances of the false imagination. They merely appear, yet while doing so, do not exist, therefore, they are false. These, as well, are entirely non-existent in actuality, since they are merely concepts and only exist as deluded appearances, they are imaginary. So, that is Kenpo Zhenga's condensation of Vasubandhu's commentary. If you remember the format of how the format of the various different authors is portrayed in this text. And so now we have Mipham's commentary. In the preceding discussion, cyclic existence was referred to as phenomena. Here, phenomena are defined as the dualistic appearance of apprehender and apprehended, or vice versa, apprehended and apprehender, and of things expressed. The latter, things expressed, refers to the expressions that are made by means of various names in seeming accordance with the way things appear. Just like the appearance of depth in a well-crafted painting, the dualistic appearances of apprehended and apprehender do occur, yet they do not have any actual establishment. They are not actually or truly established. These are falsely imagined because they appear to the mind, yet do not exist in actuality. As is the case with falling hairs and other such examples, therefore, they, meaning these appearances of duality, do exist in the sense that they appear, yet they are false in actuality or truth. So falling hairs is a common metaphor for the nature of phenomena appearing but not truly not being truly established. Falling hair referring to individuals whose eyesight is somehow damaged or altered, and so they see falling hairs. Now, sometimes this is translated as floaters, and floaters are the little lines that one sees in one's vision that are actually little imperfections in the aqueous humor of the eyeball. And we see little sticks and stuff in our vision if you look very closely. Has anybody seen floaters? Anybody have any good floaters? Yeah, we've all seen floaters, right? So probably falling hairs is the same as floaters. Now, the false imagination is referring to the three-fold scheme of the Yogacara tradition of breaking down the two truths into three aspects. There's the false imaginary, the imaginary nature, which is false. And there's the dependent nature. And I shouldn't say it's false. There's the imaginary nature of phenomena. There's the dependent nature of phenomena or reality or phenomena. And then there's the completely perfected nature of phenomena, let's say. So the imaginary nature of phenomena is the result of the conceptualizing process, here referred to by the use of the phrase names or terms. So language is a huge aspect of the way we conceptualize phenomena, but there are concepts that are nonverbal, and a good example of that is every sentient being other than humans have many concepts, but most of them are nonverbal. And we humans have concepts too that are nonverbal. So we have, we see something in front of us and we have an idea that it's a whole thing, like a chair or a table. And then we identify the word that goes with that. And that's why it's so cool sometimes to see things that are not identifiable, and to see your brain struggle to identify what it is. I've bothered most of you with the little commercial for Dolby, right? Well, I'll do that again soon. But the imaginary is what we come up with as concepts for the world, and most of those have names. There's a name for everything, as they say, and that's the false imaginary, that things like the chairs and tables and forests and people and this and that exist, whereas those are just generalizations used in order to think about things, in order to function in the world, in order to get a hold of phenomena. We conceptualize them as types. The dependent nature is, in the Yogacara tradition, is taken to be the basis, the foundation, the alaya consciousness. Sometimes it's said to be the alia itself. That's a little unclear. That varies whether it's the alia or the alia consciousness. But it's the that inexplicable, ineluctable entity that is what appears in infinite variety of forms as this and that. And in the Chittamatra tradition, they say that the dependent nature has a semi-ultimate status, it's almost truly established. Whereas in the Yogacara tradition, the dependent nature is not truly established. It's simply the alaya of vijnana. In the Chittamatra tradition, the mind-only tradition, the dependent nature is the mind, and the mind has a sort of relative aspect, which is the dependent nature that appears as whatever appears, and then it has its fully perfected nature, which is its empty, yet knowing quality or appearing quality of all phenomena. And in the Yogacara tradition, the only aspect of those three that is has any sort of truth to it, in terms of the two truths, is the fully perfected nature. So we're starting here with apprehender and apprehended. Those are conceptual projections of the most subtle type. That's like the very subtlest level of conceptuality that happens, is we think there's a perceiver and a perceived. Basic duality. Basic fundamental innate ignorance, innate belief in a separate, continuous, unitary, independent self entity, self-entity to everything.
Could I ask a question on how on something about that?
Yeah.
You referred to that as a belief. The experience of basic duality, but is it, I guess this, I don't know if this is a chicken and egg sort of question, but is it a belief, or is it that this is the way we experience,
It's different than a belief. A belief is like way down the line. It's much more conceptual, like,
Right, that's what I was thinking. And so
because
when
of
you
this
used that
and
word,
that,
I was puzzled.
sorry, they shouldn't use that word belief. We instinctively feel like things are real.
I mean, this is how we experience things. And it's not by sort of,
Deluded
it's not
sense of
exactly a
experience.
choice.
No, that's the state of samsara. That's the fundamental state of samsara. So that's the innate ignorance. And then there's the acquired ignorance, which could be equated to the realm of concepts and terminology.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Continuing with the mipham, for this reason, though the subjective mind refers to things as this and that, and makes imputations based on those appearances of duality, these expressions and imputations are also entirely devoid of establishment in terms of the actuality that they are meant to express. So you have this technical term, establishment. So what is establishment? Establishment is that something can be irrefutably asserted. And for example, through a syllogism that fulfills three three qualities. And it's a little unclear to me. I think we have to get used to the terminology, or at least I do, rather, of like, what do they mean by, in terms of the actuality, what is actuality? I guess like true nature that they are trying to express, the true reality. Indeed, since they are merely one's own conceptual imputations, whatever we may refer to as phenomena is mere imagination. Whenever we talk about things, it's the imaginary nature that we're talking about. It's the conceptual nature that we're talking about. To summarize, what is being taught here is that all the phenomena that appear in a dualistic manner and are fixated on as such are nothing more than imputations. They may appear, yet they have no nature of their own. So here we have the initial characterization of the nature of phenomena. The characteristics of phenomena. Now we have the summary of the characteristics of the intrinsic nature. On the second topic, the treatise states, furthermore, the intrinsic nature is defined as suchness, in which there is no distinction between apprehended and apprehender, the expressed and that which expresses. Furthermore, so that was the root verse by Maitreya. Now we have Kenpo Shenga. Furthermore, the intrinsic nature is defined as suchness, in which there is no distinction between apprehended and apprehender, and no distinction in terms of the expressed and that which expresses. Sounds like an espresso machine expressing. The intrinsic nature is the opposite of what was just taught, as meaning the opposite of the nature of phenomena. It is identified as suchness, the object of individual self-awareness. So this is a mipam speaking, so to speak. And this phrase, it is defined as suchness, which is the object of individual self-awareness. What is individual self-awareness? So this phrase comes up a lot, and prajna is said to be the cultivation of individual self-awareness, of individually discriminating phenomena and understanding their true nature. But it remains completely mysterious what it actually means. What does individual self-awareness mean? We just went through the process of like understanding that there are no individuals. So whose self-awareness is this? And you know, so does it mean like a single self-awareness experiences suchness? Is there one self-awareness that experiences suchness that's different from all other types of awareness or something? Somewhere, somebody's got to like explain what does this individual self-awareness mean. Anyway, perhaps throughout this text, it'll be used over and over and we'll gain an understanding of it. In suchness, there are no distinctions in terms of an apparent duality of apprehended and apprehender, and in the absence of dualistic appearances, neither is there any distinction to be made in terms of an expressed meaning and the words that express it. So concepts and their terms are not, there is no significant distinction between them, right? In terms of an expressed meaning and the words that express it. The underlying rationale for characterizing these two in this way, phenomena and their essence. On the third topic, the treatise states, since the non-existent appears, so we just went through that, all appearances are not truly existent, so It's sort of a tautology. Non-existence, appearances are non-existent, and the non-existent appears. And only non-existent things appear. Since the non-existence existent appears, delusion is the cause of thorough affliction. So delusion about the nature of appearances is the cause of affliction, of it's the fundamental root cause of samsara. Because while an illusory elephant and so forth may appear, that which exists does not. That which exists is the intrinsic nature of phenomena. Their suchness is the only thing that exists. We had in the term, the intrinsic nature is defined as suchness. He doesn't quite say that suchness exists, but here we have that implication. If either non-existence or appearance were non-existent, delusion and the absence of delusion, as well as thorough affliction and complete purification, would not make sense. If either non-existence or appearance were non-existent, if non-existence was non-existent. So non-existence is being used as synonymous with appearances. Appearances are non-existent. What appears is non-existent, and what is non-existent appears. And if whatever it is that's non-existently appearing, if it were non-existent, then there would be no delusion and no purification. It would not make sense. So, non-existence are non-existent. Are not non-existent, sorry. Let's see what they make of this. The tongue twister, Vasubandhu, Kimpojenga, and Mipham. Since the non-existent characteristics of phenomena presented above do indeed appear, color, shape, so forth, delusion is the cause of thorough affliction because the three types of thorough affliction occur due to the overfixation on these factors. And the three types of thorough affliction would be nice if they had like a glossary. Let's see what they got in the back. Tibetan English Sanskrit glossary. Three types of thorough affliction. The three types of thorough affliction occur due to the overfixation on these factors. Well, it could be the three root poisons, right? Attachment, aggression, and delusion. While an illusory elephant, jewels, grains, and so forth may appear, that twofold absence of self, which in fact exists, does not appear. So the emptiness of the self of persons and phenomena does exist, is true, is a reality. The absence of self is true, but it doesn't appear. It may be asked of non-existence and appearance, why is one not held to be non-existent? If either non-existence or appearance were non-existent, delusion and the absence of delusion, as well as thorough affliction and complete pacification, would not make sense. In other words, if they were only non-existence and no appearance, there could be no delusion because appearance itself would be absent and one would not be deluded concerning non-existence. In other words, what deludes us is appearance. What does not exist does not delude us. It's the appearance of the non-existence that deludes us. If there were no delusion, there could be no freedom from delusion either, for freedom from delusion is preceded by delusion. In the same way, there could not be any thorough affliction because it is caused by delusion. Finally, without thorough affliction, there could not be any complete purification either, for complete purification is preceded by thorough affliction. Thus, everyone would be effortlessly liberated, which contradicts what we know to be the case through perception. It certainly is not the case as far as our perception is concerned. It doesn't seem like everybody is liberated, does it?
This seems like it's saying if everybody were Samantabhadra, then we wouldn't be talking about any of this, right?
That's right. Yeah. Without thorough affliction, if there were no affliction, there would be no purification. For complete purification is preceded by thorough affliction. So purification is caused by the brought about by the overcoming of affliction. And otherwise, you can't bring about purification, I guess. On the other hand, if there were only appearance and no non-existence, there could not be any delusion either. Since non-existence would not exist, that which appears to be the case would be thoroughly established, and hence not delusion. If something is thoroughly established, it's genuinely true and not delusive. Since non-existence would not exist, that which appears to be the case would be thoroughly established.
So is this saying they're doing it in negatives, double negatives? So what are they actually saying? If things existed?
Yes, they are.
If there were existence, then what appears would actually be established and would not be delusion.
That's right.
So they're kind of taking the opposite case for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that they couch it in this weird language, in this weird negative language. Maitreya does this in his other text, distinguishing between middle and extremes that we went through some years ago. He does this whole thing in a similar way. Meepom says, next we shall establish the rationale for these appearances that do not exist in reality. Since entities appear while being non-existent in actuality, as is the case with hallucinations brought about by a disease. So, you know, this is interesting. He's using an example of one appearance within a multitude of other appearances as representative of the other appearances, but the example he's chosen is an appearance that we all know is delusive, and he's using that as an analogy for the appearances that we don't know are delusive. The reason here is that dualistic fixation manifests based on dualistic appearances. So our fixation is based on the appearance of dualistic phenomena, on a dualistic perception of appearances. This fixation in turn gives rise to various habitual tendencies. So here's the progression of samsara, beginning with ignorance, which is the delusion about dualism in general, or specifically fundamental dualism, and that gives rise to the habitual tendencies, passion, attachment, aggression, and ignorance, and so forth. just like the form of an elusive elephant conjured up by magical spells and substances, or a beautiful woman in a dream, these phenomena appear yet do not exist. That which does not exist from the outset, namely the way in which things are devoid of the two forms of self, does not appear to ordinary beings who are under the influence of such unreal appearances. So that which does not exist from the outset, namely the way in which things are devoid of the two forms, that which does exist from the outset, suchness, which is the emptiness of the twofold self, does not appear to ordinary beings. It's not accessible to beings who are deluded. Because this is the case, cyclic existence and the transcendence of suffering, as well as delusion and liberation, are tenable. Not quite sure why he lists delusion and liberation as well, because those seem to be the same as cyclic existence and its transcendence and the transcendence of suffering. If this were not the case, these principles would not make sense. There would be nothing to be liberated from. If the lack of existence and actuality paired with the appearance of that which does not appear, making it even harder to understand this. Okay, let's start at the beginning of this paragraph, because this is the case. The case being that suchness does not appear to ordinary beings who are under the influence of the appearance of what is unreal, the twofold self. Because this situation is the case, samsara, cyclic existence, and nirvana, the transcendence of suffering, as well as delusion and liberation, are therefore possible or tenable. If this were not the case, these principles would not make sense. The principles of delusion and liberation and so forth. If the lack of existence in actuality paired with the appearance of that which does not exist did not occur together, and instead one of these were not present, delusion and non-delusion would be completely untenable, as with thorough affliction and complete purification. So if there was a one-sided situation, if the lack of existence in actuality, if the suchness of the emptiness of self, of phenomena, was paired with the appearance of that which does not exist. So if there was an absence of the emptiness of self, meaning if there was actually an essence to self and persons, then the appearance of that which does not exist would not make sense. There would be no way that that which does not exist, that which does not exist is the essence of the twofold selves. And so its non-appearance would not exist, would not make sense, because it does, in this scenario, it would exist, it would appear. And he's saying, but they don't, it doesn't appear. So it continues to be conclusive that it's non-existent. The non-existence of the self, of persons and selves, the existence of the self, of persons and phenomena, does not appear. If the lack of existence in truth, paired with the appearance of that which does not exist, did not occur together. So if appearances and their emptiness, to be really simple, did not occur simultaneously, and instead one of these were not present. Let's say the emptiness of phenomena was not present when the phenomena appeared, and they appeared as real. Then delusion and non-delusion would be untenable, completely untenable, because one wouldn't be deluded by appearances.
It wouldn't just be that they appeared as real, but they would be real.
They would be real.
What they're really saying is, if there were just real things, or if there were just emptiness, then there would be no issue with delusion.
That's right.
Yeah, it's like they're trying to, in some weird way,
it's got to be both.
Make a case for a very weird negative spun case for why there is delusion. And
yeah.
if what is the case were not the case, there would be no delusion, is what they're really saying in a very odd way.
It is. It is a very odd way. And it seems to be responding to one of the most natural questions that we all ask at some point or many points of life. Why does delusion exist? You know, why did we become deluded?
Yet this doesn't actually answer that question in a way.
It doesn't answer why it happened.
Yeah, right.
It just says that they have to both be there at the same time. There's no other possibility. If things were not non-existent in truth, if things were not actually selfless, but instead had an essence and were established in the dualistic manner in which they appear as subject and object, it would not be reasonable for fixating on them in this way to be deluded or mistaken. Then, you know, fixating on them would be an accurate thing to do because they are real. Moreover, since there would be no such thing as a method for averting delusion, you can't avert delusion if there is no delusion. The transcendence of suffering would be non-existent in every respect. It's sort of like you have to have delusion in order to achieve liberation, enlightenment.
But then the question is, would there be no suffering in that scenario that they're trying to describe?
Yeah, in that imaginary world.
Because they're saying that the transcendence of suffering would be non-existent, but would it?
I think,
does that mean there would be no suffering that needed to be transcended?
I think that is not what the case would be. I think he's saying, let's say everything did have a self. And the world was just like it is now, full of suffering and misery, but that there actually are selves of persons and phenomena. That then it wouldn't make sense for there to be both delusion and liberation.
But there wouldn't. They're saying that in the case if things were that way, it wouldn't be delusion, because it would be the way it is. We're not deluded. But there still could be suffering. That's the question. I'm not clear what they're trying to say. It still could be suffering.
Yeah, he doesn't really address that, but it seems like that's the only change he's making. He's saying, let's take for example that, let's pretend that things exist the way that we think they exist, as truly, as truly existent. Take appearances to be true.
That's kind of an easy thing to do.
Every morning. So on the next page, if the occurrence of appearances were as non-existent as they are in actuality, if there were no appearances, it would not be possible for anyone to be subject to the delusion of apprehended and apprehender. If there were no appearances, we wouldn't have that delusion. In the absence of delusion, moreover, its opposite, complete purification, would also be non-existent, just as one cannot cut the non-existent horn of a rabbit. Therefore, since non-existence and appearance occur together, the thorough affliction of mistakenly believing in the existence of the non-existent is possible. Likewise, it is also possible to train the transcendence, sorry, to attain the transcendence of suffering by virtue of the path on which one is freed from delusion by knowing the non-existent to be non-existent. Why does he say it in this way?
It would be fascinating to know what the pedagogical benefit of going into that particular extreme that he just did, explaining everything in the inverse.
Yeah. It seems like he's answering the question of why does things appear even though they're not real? Okay, so are phenomena and their intrinsic nature the same or different? Are these two aspects of reality the same or different? On the fourth topic, the treatise states these two are neither the same nor different because the existent and non-existent have differences as well as none. I guess it's poetry, you know, and he's trying to teach Dharma in a poetic way, so it comes across as complete riddle world. It may then be asked, are phenomena and their intrinsic nature one and the same, or are they different? These two, phenomena and their intrinsic nature, are neither the same nor different because the existent, the intrinsic nature, and the non-existent phenomena have differences and thus cannot be the same, as well as none, for the intrinsic nature is distinguished as the mere non-existence of phenomena, and thus these two cannot be different either. Two things cannot be the same or different if one of them doesn't exist, right? That's the main point. So it's similar to when we talk about what's the relationship between the self and the skandhas. Anyone venture a guess? The relationship between the self and the skandhas. Friends? Relatives? Former partners. They broke up. Chris?
The skandhas is the manifestation of the self, which doesn't exist.
The skandhas are a manifestation of the self, which doesn't exist. Wow. Okay. What do other people think of that?
The manifestation of the skandhas. Yes, that's it.
The self is a manifestation of the skandhas. Is that your final answer? The self is a manifestation of the skandhas.
The skandhas are the basis for the imputation of the self.
Ah, that's a nuance. So what about the skandhas and the self?
Well, there is no self.
Exactly. So there's no relationship. There's zippo. You can't have a relationship between something that exists and something that doesn't exist. Which was what Chris was getting at, but didn't quite say it in that way. Okay, so the two are neither the same nor different because the existent and non-existent have differences as well as none. It may then be asked, are phenomena and their intrinsic nature one and the same or different? The two phenomena and their intrinsic nature are neither the same nor different because the existent, the intrinsic nature, and the non-existent phenomena have differences and thus cannot be the same as well as none, for the intrinsic nature is distinguished as the mere non-existence of phenomena, and thus these two cannot be different either. That's a little bit easier than the first couple of paragraphs. Cyclic existence and the transcendence of suffering, or phenomena and their intrinsic nature, are neither identical in essence nor essentially different. How so? The intrinsic nature, the transcendence of suffering that is completely pure by its very nature, exists from the outset as the way things are. Suchness exists as the way things are. The phenomena that possess this nature, that's an interesting way of phrasing it. On the other hand, meaning the phenomena of cyclic existence, appear in a dualistic manner, but are not what they seem in terms of the way things are. Things are not as they seem. In this sense, there is a difference between these two. Thus, conventionally speaking, phenomena and their intrinsic nature are not the same. It must also be understood that these two are not different either. If one did not exist, neither would the remaining factor. Similarly, aside from the intrinsic nature being delineated by the mere lack of establishment of phenomena in reality, these two are not distinct from one another. Indeed, the distinction between the existent intrinsic nature and the non-existent phenomena that possess it is relative. So this idea that phenomena possess their suchness is a relative concept. Other than being what must be accepted and rejected respectively, there is not even the slightest existence of any existence that would establish these two as different objects.
So it's interesting that here we're talking about phenomena, not appearances.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than being what must be accepted and rejected, that's all that we can say about phenomena. Even if they are non-existent, they can be accepted or rejected. Respectively, there's not even the slightest existence of any essence that would establish these two as different. Okay, detailed explanation. Now we dive into the more extensive. The second section contains two divisions, a detailed explanation of phenomena and a detailed explanation of their intrinsic nature. First, phenomena. The first topic is divided further into a presentation of the topics and an examined explanation of each individual topic. So first, an introductory overview, and then a detailed perusal. A presentation of the topics. On the first, the treatise states, the sixfold access to phenomena is supreme. What is the sixfold access?
Is that the six senses?
I think so. I can't imagine what else it would be. Because it allows for the full access to characteristics establishment, the absence of sameness and difference, the shared basis and the unshared, and the non-existent of what appears to be apprehended and appear apprehender.
Unless that list itself is the sixfold access.
Oh, are there six?
I'm not entirely sure. It depends on how you count. Characteristics, establishment, absence, shared basis, non-existence. I don't know. It's close. It depends on whether you count some of these things that have two as two or one.
Yeah, I would go with the six collections. Of these two phenomena, so on page 16, of these two phenomena and their intrinsic nature, which are not different from one another, how should one access phenomena Or how may one access phenomena well? That's an interesting distinction. How should we access phenomena, or how should we access phenomena well? The sixfold access to phenomena explained here is supreme because it allows for the full access to characteristics, establishment, the absence of sameness and difference, the alarmed basis and the alarmed and the unshared, sorry, the shared basis and the unshared. The non-existence of what appears to be apprehended in the apprehender. The sixfold access to phenomena explained here is supreme because it allows for the full access to characteristics, establishment, the absence of sameness and difference, the shared basis, the unshared basis, and the non-existence of what appears to be apprehended in apprehender. So they're implying that this is the six. The sixfold approach to understanding outlined here involves relating to phenomena via study and contemplation. It's an odd list. Like, you would think that the sixfold approach would appear in other texts. So on the prior page on the bottom, that stanza says, the sixfold access to phenomena is supreme because it allows for the full access to characteristics established.
It's the same list as on the next page.
It is.
Yes, it's just, as I said, it just depends. The way they split shared and unshared was the one I wasn't able to count correctly because,
Yep. Yeah, so it's just Vasubandhu parsing it. Glossing it slightly. Okay, so Mipam. The sixfold approach to understanding outlined here involves relating to phenomena through study and contemplation. This is the supreme way to ascertain these phenomena. The reasoning here is that this approach allows one to access the nature of the samsaric phenomena that are meant to be relinquished, whereby one may ascertain the entire range of such phenomena with ease. This approach allows one to access the nature of the samsaric phenomena that are meant to be relinquished, whereby one may ascertain the entire range of such phenomena with ease. Okay. So if we can access one phenomena's nature in this way, then we can apply that universally. The expansion of the, or the pervasion, they call it, using the same logic to pervade all other members of a certain set. In this case, the set being phenomena which appear dualistically. These six ways of relating to phenomena are as follows. Relating to the objects of one's understanding, i.e. the characteristics of samsaric phenomena. 2. Demonstrating how the characteristics of these phenomena are established as such. 3. Understanding and relating to the way in which phenomena and their intrinsic nature are neither the same nor different. And 4, understanding the shared abode of cyclic existence. And 5, understanding how this abode is not shared. And 6, understanding how to thoroughly access the fact of the non-existence of what appears to be apprehended in apprehender. Presenting phenomena in terms of these six allows one to fully understand the issue. So the six, once more, are relating to the objects of one's understanding, which are the characteristics of samsaric phenomena, to demonstrating how the characteristics of these phenomena are established, Three, understanding and relating to the way in which phenomena and their nature are neither the same nor different. Four, understanding the shared abode of cyclic existence. So we saw this earlier, that there's this idea that there's a shared aspect of mind, of the projection of everything for, as mind, and there's an unshared aspect of everything being mind, and the outer container is the shared. Understanding how this abode is not shared is the unshared aspect of the abode, which is our own mind streams. We all have our own experiences, our own accumulation of karma and development of latent tendencies. And six, understanding how to thoroughly access the fact of the non-existence of what appears to be apprehended and apprehender. So how do we understand the non-existence of all of these things? Presenting phenomena in terms of these six allows one to fully understand the issue. So, interesting. I wonder if it relates to the six discoveries of Vipassana. The meaning of each individual topic. The second section shows how the first three topics have already been taught and explains the last three topics. So, the first three topics, the treatise states, of these characteristics, establishment, and the absence of sameness and difference are, as was briefly taught above. So, the absence of sameness and difference was taught most recently, and the characteristics and establishment were covered before that.
Didn't we also touch on the sixth one to some extent already? I'm not sure, but that seems like...
How to thoroughly access the fact of the non-existence of what appears?
It seems like we've at least touched on the non-existence. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the idea of the summary, is that it touches on all of these points and then it goes into them in more detail.
Right, but it's funny that this one, here they're sort of saying, well, we already talked about the first three, so, but that's why it seemed like that one was also touched on, but maybe not sufficiently for them to consider it touched on.
Oh, I see. He's going to go through the others in more detail now.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I just was puzzled because it seems like we did... It seems like some of the prior sections did address six a little bit, but maybe not, maybe only tangentially.
Yeah, okay, we'll see how he covers it going forward and how it differs. Of the six vectors, the access presented here, characteristics, establishment, the absence of sameness and difference are to be understood as was explained above. The second section is divided into explanations of the two modes and how to relate with the reality or to the reality of the absence of apprehended and apprehender. The first explanation is further divided into a summary of both of the two abodes in common and an extensive individual explanations of the significance of each of the two abodes, a summary of the shared and unshared abodes. Concerning the first, the treatise states that which cycles and where the cycling takes place abides throughout as the constituents of sentient beings and their environment. The constituents of the environment appear shared and are as such shared awareness. The constituents of sentient beings are shared, but also unshared. So this really helpful and interesting way of talking about the idea of everything being a projection of mind is that, you know, why do we all see the same things? Because we live in a shared projection. And they don't really, it doesn't really explain how that happens. Like, did that happen at one point in time, the shared experience of the environment? Or did it increase over time? Was there like a process of becoming more aligned over the the series of infinite rebirths. You know, presumably the idea is that we've all been born over and over again in this shared environment. Possibly other shared environments, but I think the idea
is could just be constant co-creating, right?
That's another option, is we could be constantly co-creating our outer reality. And when we discover things, like they discovered the smallest dinosaur eggs ever, right? So when we discover things like that, we mutually create them. Or did we create them in the past? Those dinosaur eggs are 80 million years old. Did we create them in the past?
And then what, forgot about them for a while? It's like, yeah, was it like Kerma?
We buried them. We buried
like
them.
Like Kerma.
Okay.
It would be nice if somebody would sit down and explain this all right in more detail.
Yeah. let's see. That which cycles and where the cycling takes place is the Tour de France. And it abides throughout as the constituents of sentient beings and their environment. The constituents of the environment appear shared and are as such shared awareness. The constituents of sentient beings are shared but also unshared. The phenomena of cyclic existence are that which cycles and where the cycling takes place. These abide pervasively throughout as the constituents of sentient beings and their environment. The constituents of the environment appear as a shared experience and are as such the shared experience appearance of awareness. They are shared awareness because the consciousness associated with such appearances arises within the individual mind streams of all sentient beings. The constituents of sentient beings are shared but also unshared. Meepom, the constituents of sentient beings are that which cycles, while the constituents of the environment are the context within which this continuous cycling, i.e. of rebirths, takes place in the in the form of rebirth. The world of sentient beings and the world of the environment are known as the abodes throughout which beings cycle. Aside from these two, the supported constituents of sentient beings and the constituents of the environment that is their support, there is no other abode of cyclic existence whatsoever. Of these, one may wonder what is shared and what is not. The constituents of the world's environment are referred to as shared abodes insofar as they appear collectively to those sentient beings whose active habitual tendencies correspond with one another and who have corresponding perceptions or consciousnesses. The phenomena that comprise the constituents of sentient beings, however, are both shared and non-shared. The second section contains explanations rather of shared abodes and those that are not shared. Shared abodes, concerning the first of these, the treatise states, furthermore, birth, conventions, support, subjugation, benefit, harm, good qualities, and flaws mutually cause one another by ruling. They are therefore shared. Furthermore, birth, looking, and other conventions, the support or subjugation enacted by others, benefiting and harming others, learning and other good qualities, and flaws like desire are present in individual mind streams. These factors mutually cause one another by being the ruling conditions for one another. They are therefore classified as constituents of sentient beings that are shared. The phenomena of Meepom, the phenomena categorized as the constituents of sentient beings, can be classified as follows. Womb births, perceptible physical and verbal conventions, supporting or subjugating another, benefiting, harming, the arising of the positive qualities associated with learning, and other such factors that depend upon another. sorry, and other such factors that depend upon another and the occurrence of flaws like desire. One more time. The phenomena categorized as the constituents of sentient beings can be classified as womb birth, perceptible physical and verbal conventions, supporting or subjugating another, benefiting, harming, the arising of the positive qualities associated with learning other such factors that depend upon another, and the occurrence of flaws like desire. It's an interesting list from among all the sort of shared constituents that one could come up with. They come up with this list. For consciousness that manifests in this manner to occur, sentient beings must serve as the ruling conditions for one another and thereby mutually cause one another. For this reason, they are termed shared appearances. Birth, for example, occurs as a shared experience insofar as one's karma functions as the cause and the seeds of one's parents as the simultaneous conditions. This shared cause, in turn, results in a baby born from the womb coming into existence. So three factors involved in the birth of a sentient being: the previous accumulation of karmic functions is the main cause, and the seeds received from the parents are the supporting conditions. Likewise, the next paragraph, shared conventions involve observing and communicating with others as well as other such activities that are instigated by another individual's physical or verbal communication. This is the case when one person cares for another in either a spiritual or material sense, defeats them in an argument, in combat, or otherwise, helps them by protecting them from something they are afraid of or benefiting them in another way, harms them by beating them or through some other form of violence, develops positive qualities through study, or creates faults by teaching negative views, arousing desire, and so on. Thus, situations where one individual acts as the ruling condition and the phenomena of another person's mind stream functions as the primary cause are referred to as shared from the perspective of there being a single shared result. What would that single shared result be? The outer environment, I guess. Conventionally, these results are brought about by a collection of causes and conditions. In actuality, however, using the term ruling cause also indicates that there are no collectively experienced external objects. The reason here is that there are no external objects to function as observed conditions aside from consciousness, nor are the external environment or other seemingly shared experiences anything more than the objective aspect of the inner consciousness. Wow.
So it seems like the key point of this in this shared one is really about the karmic interconnections of things. The whole cause and the...
Yeah, the cause, the main cause and the conditions. Collection of causes and conditions. So that last paragraph, conventionally these results are brought about by a collection of cause and conditions. In actuality, however, using the term ruling cause also indicates that there are no collectively experienced external objects.
Yeah, it seems like this actually undoes whatever my concept of what this shared thing was. I think I when we first hear about this, it seems to be described as if it were a, what do they call it, collectively experienced I guess it's that it's not an externality. I guess that's the key, that they're trying to make that point.
Yeah.
It's collectively experienced, but it's not external.
Right. It's a shared internal experience for all of us, which would imply, if not say, that I'm experiencing my environment and you're experiencing yours, but we share such common patterns of karma that we experience an identical shared an identical environment, I guess. Interesting. Okay. Well, you know, later in the course, we will finish this with this book, and then we can look at another commentary from Carl's book. I had suggested Vasubandhu's, but because of the size, basically, it's the shortest. But we basically have Vasubandhu's here, and it might be interesting. The others in there are by Rongchen Dorje and Gorampa. Rongchen Dorje's is very long, but maybe we can focus in on a few interesting sections, such as this. The Unshared Abodes. On the second topic, the treatise states, yes, ma'am.
How do we know that our shared experience is identical?
We don't, do we? It's consistent though, right? You know, like we all say, we all see red, you know, and you can point to red, examples of red, and we can say, you know, I think that's red. And then you can point to another instance of red and say, yeah, I think this is red. And I can say, yeah, it's the same color as the red that I pointed to. But we don't really know what your red is. I don't really know what your red is, and you don't really know what mine is, but they're consistent.
And they may not be exactly the same. I mean, as you said, there's no way of knowing it, but it's similar enough that it seems like we're in the same environment.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
At the same time, I think we also know that there are differences in how we perceive.
Yeah.
So it's not, I think it's It's
and
not,
the phenomena are not truly existent, so they don't have like any objectively real, stable existence that can be viewed by different people in different ways. It's basically we all are experiencing the same, a similar projection at the same time in the same place.
It's even more complex than the eight people on the elephant, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, so, you know, the typical thing is you say, well, what happens when there's an experience of something that has never appeared before? You know, do we, like, how does that happen? And that
how
story
would we
of
know
like,
if that happened? Like,
yeah,
how would
we wouldn't.
Really know if something had never happened before?
But yeah, it's possible things are appearing that we're not able to see, right? Like other beings we're not able to see are supposedly appearing all the time. But like the story of Columbus and other explorers coming into this physical geographical area and the inhabitants of this area not being able to perceive them because they've never understood that such things could exist. There's no way we can possibly know if there's any truth to that story, but it's an interesting idea. I don't know where I got that from, but this idea that like the indigenous peoples like couldn't see the ships, and so they did not in any way prepare for being invaded by beings from those ships. I don't know. That's I don't know how anyone can possibly conclude that. But okay, so the unshared abodes. On the second topic, the treatise states abode, awareness, pleasure, pain, karma, death, transference, birth, bondage, and liberation are not shared. Hence, these are unshared abodes. Well, what then is not shared, one may ask? The abode, meaning the all-ground consciousness, not the all-ground, but the all-ground consciousness, the awareness, i.e. the engaged consciousnesses. Using the term awareness as synonymous with consciousness here, pleasure and pain, and that is generally the case in the four schools, that awareness and consciousness are synonymous.
Is there a difference between the, I mean, it says the engaged consciousnesses, is that different than just
unengaged consciousness? Is there? That's a good question. The terminology implies that, but I think it's more like the consciousnesses which are engaged, or it could be like engaged consciousnesses, instead of the gives the sense that maybe there's other consciousnesses aren't.
Or could this mean first they refer to the abode, meaning the all ground, and then they say the awareness, i.e. the engaged, could that refer to the other six or seven?
It could, yeah. Yeah, it could. That's good. Thank you. It sounds that way, yeah. Pleasure and pain, virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral, karma, death and transference, birth, and bondage and liberation are not shared in this way because they are not embodied and because they are to be cognized individually. These factors are not causes for the arising of corresponding awarenesses within distinct mind streams. Hence, these are unshared abodes, and so on. The abode, so Mipa, meaning the all-ground consciousness, here we go, the seven, thank you, collections of awareness, the individual experiences of pleasure and pain, the karma accumulated through intention, death and transference, taking birth in an individual existence, and being both bound in and liberated from cyclic existence are all unshared phenomena within individual mind streams. These unshared experiential factors within individual mind streams are not experienced in common with other sentient beings. Hence, these are the unshared abodes of sentient beings. Okay, so that completes the introductory presentation of phenomena and their nature. And now we have this section on the essential non-existence of the duality of apprehended and apprehender. This second section contains two discussions, an explanation of the tenet of mere awareness in the absence of external reference, and two, how to access the reality of there being neither apprehended nor apprehender, independent of awareness. How to access being, presumably the transformation, maybe? An explanation of the tenet of mere awareness in the absence of external reference. The first topic contains two further divisions showing that there is no apprehended object independent of what apprehends it, and how to dispense with any uncertainties. There is no apprehended object apart from what apprehends it. Concerning the first topic, the treatise states the appearance of a shared, externally apprehended object is the apprehending awareness. Apart from consciousness, there is no external object because it is shared. It sounds like the logic, they're saying that because it's shared, therefore there is no external object. That's an interesting twist. Let's see what Meepom says. In terms of accessing the non-existence of the apparent apprehended and apprehender, the appearance of a shared externally apprehended object is the apprehending awareness of a distinct stream of being itself. The apprehended awareness itself of a distinct stream of being. We are distinct streams of being, I think. When it appears to an apprehending awareness, apart from consciousness, there is no external object. Why? Because it is the shared awareness of the environment. The external, so-called, there is no external. All that we experience is the shared awareness of the environment, the shared awareness of the environment. It's not the shared environment, it's the shared awareness of the environment. If there was an external object, there would be the shared environment. But thus, although an awareness that takes the form of this experience arises in individual mind streams, the awareness of one is not the object of another. It's sort of like a story or a movie where a group of people are transported to another realm where they all have a shared illusion. And they all imagine the same thing happening. And they all have different reactions to it.
It's just odd that they use the term the environment, because that still seems to suggest that there's a thing, you know, that is not
true.
Just awareness. That it's just the languaging is a little...
Yeah, how would you say it? Because it is the shared awareness of an environment of...
Yes, I think just the... Environment. I think an is what came to my mind. An as opposed
yeah.
to the. It
yeah.
makes a big difference in an odd way.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so Meepom, and we'll finish this little section, and those with overt fixation on external objects, like all of us, may entertain the following thought: no one can deny the presence of material objects, such as mountains and all the other things that we collectively observe. For this very reason, outer objects do indeed exist. This, however, is not the case. Let us take as our subject a mountain or another object that appears collectively as an externally apprehended object. Such an object is not established by virtue of its own essence as an external material object that is something other than the inner consciousness that perceives it. Why? Because it is the very inner apprehending awareness of those whose active habitual tendencies correspond with one another that appears as various outer objects, just like the imagery in a dream, in dreams. So the implication is that all humans have a shared karma of habitual tendencies, so we see things in a similar way, and frogs have their own shared karma, and insects and crocodiles and so forth, dogs. Therefore, there are no external objects apart from consciousness. What we refer to as collectively observed external objects are appearances that manifest collectively to various individuals with distinct streams of being, and hence nothing more than the perceptions of individual streams of being. What is the reason for this, one may ask? The so-called collectively observed objects that supposedly prove the existence of outer objects are posited to be collectively experienced outer objects, merely because they appear in a similar manner to the conditioned perspective of a variety of individual mind streams. There's nothing more to it than that. That's interesting. We all say, like, as a proof of external objects, we say, well, we all see the same things. And he's saying, just because you all see the same things is no proof that they are actually external. There's nothing more to it than that. These appearances are the perceptions of the individual mind streams that witness them. It is utterly impossible for them to be shared. Those mind streams, I guess. The so-called outer object that is something other than such a mere appearance, and that is collectively experienced, can never be logically established as such. Otherwise, one would have to posit the existence of the object apart from its appearance to a mind. It does not, however, make sense to posit something that cannot appear, since there would be no valid cognition by which such an object could be evaluated. I guess he's saying that if there were independent external objects, then they would have the quality of either appearing or not appearing. And there's no way that you could possibly know something that doesn't appear. Something like that. Otherwise, one would have to posit the existence of the object apart from its appearance to a mind. There would have to be something, two phenomena separate from their appearance.
Well, the question, it seems, is that we would have no means of knowing if that exists or not.
Right. And so for us Westerners, that is not a conclusive reason, right? Just because we can't possibly know them doesn't mean that they're not there.
It's not quite as obvious. Yeah, the logic isn't quite as like automatic for us, certainly, as it seems to be for them. But I think that's just, in a way, familiarity. They're kind of familiar with these arguments, and so they can rattle them off as if they make sense and are unopposable, you know.
Yeah.
For us, we're like, wait a minute.
It's like saying just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody isn't actually out to get you. So at the bottom of
would be
22.
Fun to have. I mean, how do the scientists in the room, people who have more of a science background, does this rattle your sort of scientific approach? That's.
Yeah, I'm sure that they're not buying into it any one bit, I'm sure. That's why they're not saying anything. If we carefully analyze these so-called collectively observed phenomena, we will find that the reason for positing them as such is that they appear in a similar manner to distinct mind streams. Nevertheless, while these appearances may be similar, this does not necessitate there being a single collectively experienced outer object that causes their appearance. Just as people whose vision has been distorted by a magician's spells may have similar experiences. For those beings whose active habitual tendencies correspond with one another, the abode and other such factors may appear in a similar manner, so long as the potency of these habitual tendencies has not run out. The potency, whoa. Let's try that again. For those beings whose active habitual tendencies correspond with one another, such as all humans, the abode and other such factors may appear in a similar manner so long as the potency of those habitual tendencies has not run out. If the potency of those habitual tendencies ran out, then we wouldn't be born in this realm, right? However, no cause of those corresponding appearances truly exists outside of the minds that perceive them, just as each of the six classes of beings perceives the six classes of beings of the six realms, I guess, perceives the same water differently. Yes, in accord with its karmic perceptions, it should be understood that such appearances are nothing more than the self appearances of one's own inner mind. That famous example of water being viewed as pus by the hungry ghosts, as molten led by hell beings, as something to fly through for fish, something to walk upon for small insects, something to drink for larger animals and humans, and Amrita for the gods. What about the demigods, the Asuras? What is water for them?
I'm
Same
not
as the
sure I've ever
gods.
heard. Maybe they just lumped it. Sometimes they lump them together.
Yeah, they're the same as Amrita. Maybe not as good Amrita. It's like not as sweet or something. Anyway, I don't think we should launch into the next section. Can't remember where our requirement was tonight. Does anybody have that? Where's my syllabus when I need it?
I think it was
Any
28.
comments so far? Sorry?
I think it was 28.
Oh, don't say that. Oh.
Okay. 23. I think it was 23.
Oh, we could go to 26. Why don't we do that? Dispensing with uncertainties. On the second topic, the treatise states its counterpart is the apprehended. Its counterpart is the out apprehended object awareness that is not shared. So the counterpart of the shared environment is the unshared object of awareness that is apprehended. The minds and so forth of others, these are not the mutual objects of apprehending awarenesses, whether out of a meditative equipoise or within, because for those not in equipoise, it is their thoughts that appear, whereas for those who are in equipoise, it is a reflection of these that appears within the field of a particular absorption. So they have like a reflective quality of the projection of conceptual mind in the field of an absorption. Well, let's see the explanation. Its counterpart is the apprehended object of awareness that is not shared, the minds and so forth of others, thus including mental states. These are not the mutual objects of apprehending awarenesses, whether these awarenesses are out of meditative equipoise or within equipoise. This is because for those who are not in equipoise, it is their thoughts that appear, and thus the object is not the mind and so forth of others. Those who are not in equipoise, it is their thoughts that appear, and thus the object is not the mind and so forth of others. We don't see others' projection of phenomena. Other people's experience of their inner unshared world. Whereas for those who are in equipoise, it is a reflection of these that appears within the field of a particular absorption. I think they're saying you can perceive the projection of other people's minds, maybe. And thus the object is not the minds of others and so forth. Not the minds and so forth of others. Therefore, because it is one's own awareness that is the object, no objects exist external to consciousness, and because no such objects exist, that which appears to be apprehended is non-existent as well. It just appears within mind. All that appears is indeed merely what appears in the mind. One may object. No one can refute this. Nevertheless, so this is the objection. All that appears is indeed merely what appears in the mind. One may object. No one can refute this. Nevertheless, this does not prove that all appearances are substantially identical to the mind, nor does it prove that there are no outer objects associated with the appearances one observes. For instance, one person's mind can be directly perceived by another. Yet this does not prove that the other person's mind stream does not exist, or that the appearance of this mind is substantially identical to one's own mind. The same can then be said concerning outer objects. So this whole paragraph is the objection. Objecting to the statement.
Does it seem like they're talking about the ability for people to
Yes, to read each
yeah.
other's minds.
Right.
Yes. which they take as a reality, that people can do that. People who have achieved absorption states can do that. In response, we may argue as follows. In addition to cognitions of the world, of the environment, and other seemingly shared experiences, there are also apprehended objects of awareness or consciousness that are not shared. The mind's mental events and so forth that comprise the mind streams of other sentient beings, such a consciousness may indeed accurately cognize the minds of other individuals through the power of knowledge, mantras, meditative absorption, and so forth. However, regardless of whether or not the subject is resting in meditative equipoise, it is not the case that the apprehending awareness is actually taking another mind stream as its object. How so? For those not in equipoise, it is their own thought activity that appears in a manner that resembles another individual's mind. While for those in equipoise, it is a reflection of the other individual's mind that appears within the experiential domain of their meditative absorption, similar in form to knowing the past or future. In other words, it is merely an image that resembles the other person's mind. So, it's, what is the, for those not in equipoise, it is their own thought activity that appears in a manner that resembles another individual's mind. So we think we're seeing, for those of us who are not accomplished, we think we're understanding what other people are experiencing, because we sort of sense that they're experiencing what we experience, and so we project that onto them. Whereas if you are in absorption, you see the reflection. It is a reflection of the other individual mind that appears. That's interesting, a reflection of it. It's not their actual mind. That's a funny distinction. Therefore, the way the mind may take on the feature of an object that it observes is different from cognizing an object in such a way that the mind itself is substantially identical to the object. So, the mind taking on the feature of an object that it observes, like taking on the feeling of happiness or suffering of another person, is substantially in such a way that the mind itself is substantially identical to the object. That's a different experience.
When we have one experience, it's similar to the basic notion that when we think we're seeing, we're really just seeing an aspect. Remember, of course, in this case, we're talking that there's nothing out there. Yeah, okay, I don't know which we're not in the conventional sense of sense experience here. So I guess.
Yeah, I think that's the foundation. And then they're going through, like, so what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah.
Therefore, there are two different modes of cognition, one in which the mind takes on the features of the object it observes, and another in which the mind arises in a way that is substantially identical to that object. So when it takes on the features of what it observes, for instance, okay, an example, thank you, a yogi may observe the happiness, suffering, or some other state of an ordinary mind and be cognizant of it as such, while not having a comparable experience oneself. Well, so the rejoinder of the objection. So we just finished this page. While it may indeed be the case that outer objects are not directly experienced, one may counter, they can still be experienced through the arising of certain features, as was the case with another individual's mind. How would that present any problem? Oh, so the other person is saying, well, if you believe in other people's minds as being external, why don't you believe in phenomena as being external? Wow, that's a great question.
Right. That's a fair and reasonable question, because in a sense they always say that mind only is not like solipsism, right? So yeah. And yet
there are other minds. Let's see what he says. In response, we may say that consciousness itself manifests in a manner that resembles an object due to the activation of internal habitual tendencies. Okay, that's the general principle, right? Moreover, without such habitual tendencies, outer objects would not appear as in enlightened persons, even if we were to grant that they exist. This we can see to be the case with hungry ghosts and water and those in the realm of boundless space and forms. They don't see water. They don't see forms. When internal habitual tendencies become active, on the other hand, a discrete outer object need not be present, as we can see to be the case with hungry ghosts who perceive pus and the all-pervasive space perceived by those in the realm of infinite space. They're not seeing actual objects. Therefore, it is clear that appearances occur due to the mind. Mind does not occur due to appearances. Similarly, it is not that the mind stream of one person occurs due to the mind of someone else, since one cannot accept the position that one person transcending suffering would necessitate everyone transcending suffering. We know that from the example of the Buddha. He achieved enlightenment and nobody else automatically did. Well then, one may respond, since all phenomena are directly perceptible to the Buddha, if what appeared to them were substantially identical to their wakefulness, then Buddhas and sentient beings would turn out to be of one single mind stream. In the case of the Buddha, the notion of a mind stream that is different from that of a sentient being is not relevant. Sort of like our example of what's the difference between the self and the skandhas. Since this is the wakefulness of complete transformation that accords with the intrinsic nature of things, it is impossible to make delineations concerning sameness, difference, or otherwise. So dismissing the objection. On this point, it is taught, unborn and unceasing, the intrinsic nature is the same as nirvana. Well, that was not utterly convincing, was it? But interesting the way they deal with this. Interesting that this text like launches off into this whole issue of like, okay, if things are actually mental projections, what does that mean? How do we understand like our shared experiences in our unshared world? It's pretty neat. I've never seen any other text that talks about these things. That's cool. Any thoughts, suggestions, comments? Anything? Yes.
Well, I just having this feeling tonight, like of nostalgia for the present, like of being so fortunate that we're here and we're safe, and that we get to study Dharma with our dear teacher Derek and all of you.
Yeah, I think that's a shared experience that we all have of like the possibility of impending doom that could totally.
But I feel pretty optimistic, but still, even so, like just this moment, like one of those things when the third month of the 22nd and the hunter moon, and it's just the fact that this moment somehow, I don't know, feels precious.
Yeah, let's appreciate these last moments of stability. It could be awful. Hopefully it will not be. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you, Barbara. That's a good aspiration to end on. What?
Maybe I should leave it there, but given that you brought in that whole subject of the wider reality that we function in terms of what we are talking about in this chapter about shared reality, one thing I found kind of coming up while we were going through it was, to what extent does this, while we have shared reality in some ways, we also have this, you know, things like the polarization and these, you know, different truths and all that sort of thing that are going on if you are into the politics of the moment. And so I was wondering, to what extent is that also explained by different conditioning, that while we're talking about, in one sense, we have a shared reality, but that some aspects of that, what we think of as shared, are not really commonly shared. Do you know what I mean? And that therefore this polarization is the result of sort of different conditioning that, you know, so we don't think of like fellow humans as having a different shared reality, but, you know, if you read the papers, that is kind of what's going on, alternative facts and all that stuff. So is that actually a symptom of sort of different subsets of human shared reality that could be explained similarly to what we're talking about in this chapter? Do you know what I mean?
Any responses to Cynthia?
Well, your shared reality comes right from your culture. And in New York, the New York culture, and now I'm in upstate, which is a totally different culture. It's rural, and we do share a reality. It's just our concepts are different, our conceptual thinking. So I have to reframe stuff a lot when I communicate with people up here because they have a different reality. But ultimately, I get through and we do share a reality. So, yeah. And evidence of that is they're inviting me to be on different committees, and I'm a VP of two different groups now. Yet I'm a New York Democratic Socialist, which, you know, they got Trump signs up here. So, yeah. It's kind of what you're saying. It's the conditioning. And you have to break through that.
I wonder about latent karmic tendencies and where we are going, all the people on the planet, with the increase in the frequency of violent death and starvation, nuclear weapons. It's not an accident. So.
Now you're getting into, is it just a decline of the American empire, or is it?
No, I guess humankind, I guess, is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
All the people on the planet and how we all affect the other people on the planet and are affected by other people on the planet.
And there's a lot of us.
And yet, yeah. No planet, maybe.
Yeah, that too. Well, that's included in the shared, the latent karmic tendencies, I guess. What we all can do to each other, planet-wise. That's all.
Planet-wise.
Well, we share a planet. That's definitely true. If you focus on the planet.
Planet-wise. Planet-wise, a wise planet, the wisdom of the planet. Well, cool. Let's end on that note and see what happens. By this merit may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Thank you,
everyone. Share your environment. Take care. See you soon. Be well.
Good night.